Hello and welcome to No Directions 2017 Gen Con Seminar Coverage. Special thanks to our Gen Con volunteers, Eric Bring the Knives and Andrew Mullins. For more seminars and other great Pathfinder content, visit NoDirectionPodcast.com.
I'm in Vancouver. I used to be the regional coordinator for Western Canada for organized play. And now I get the privilege of being the moderator for this panel and running games at Gen Con and other conventions around North America. To my left.
I'm Jeremy Crawford. I'm the lead designer of the 5th edition Player's Handbook, also one of the designers of the Blue Rose role-playing game, and also the lead rules developer for Dungeons & Dragons.
I'm F. Wesley Schneider. I'm the co-creator of the Pathfinder role-playing game, and I've done work on Dungeons & Dragons on a spectrum of RPGs, this, that, and the other thing. And I'm a big nerd, apparently, said the rude lady. That's me.
I am not Catherine Cross. Unfortunately, Catherine had some travel issues, so I have decided to be that person and go, hey, y'all are all white, I'm going to go on the panel. So I'm Tiny DePass. I'm also one of the industry insiders. I talk a lot about diversity online. If you ever saw I Need Diverse Games anywhere, that was me being literally mad about games at 6 in the morning a few years ago. And now I run a nonprofit. I write a lot about games and diversity and first year at Gen Con, so I'm really enjoying it. So thanks. Wes, not so suddenly.
So this panel is traditionally pretty chill. We're going to field questions from people in the audience, and I'll kind of like point to people, we'll get some conversation going, and in the meantime, we just kind of let these guys and gals yak it up. If you have anything to like say or just raise your hand and I'll flag down and then... Yeah.
Do you want us to each sort of do a quick year in review?
I do want you to do a year in review. Okay. There's been a lot happening in the last year.
We should also let them know who else is coming.
Okay. On the way is Crystal Fraser from Paizo, and as well Joseph Kerker, who is a published author now of Sacred Bands. And they'll be coming in anytime, and when they do, we'll do a proper intro with them, and we'll inject them into the conversation. So in the meantime, please, a year in review.
Please let us know if you can't hear us. Yeah. We've been in this room many... Yeah, you... Okay. And that's also why I stand, because it's usually easier then for you to hear. I'll focus on year in review with Dungeons & Dragons, as well as Blue Rose, and I'll leave it to my friends to talk about other things queer-related going on in gaming, not only tabletop games, but also in this panel we will sometimes veer into also what's going on in video games when it comes to queer content. So in 5th edition D&D, over the past year, we have continued to make sure that queer people are present in our adventure material. That's also true coming up in Tomb of Annihilation, where we are continuing our work, and this is something I've talked about at this panel before, of ensuring that LGBT characters are depicted as naturally a part of our worlds as anybody else. And so, as I've said in this panel before, we have a very matter-of-fact approach to our queer characters. It's like they're there, and they're there just as much as everybody else. Also, there is a new edition out this year of Blue Rose, the very queer role-playing game that I co-designed with Steve Kenson about 10 years ago, with a little sort of trivia. Thank you. And which at the time, we've mentioned before, at the time when it came out, it was a very different time than we're in now, because the contrast is when the 5th edition D&D Player's Handbook came out and referred to in the character creation section to you choosing your character's sexual orientation and your gender identity, that was largely applauded. You know, go back in time to when Blue Rose came out, a game where there was same-sex marriage, polyamory, a full spectrum of queerness, and oh boy, did the internet burn itself down. and so it's been gratifying to see Blue Rose reemerge in an evolving cultural context. And also, I was just going to say with some pride, a little sort of trivia note about Blue Rose. The cartographer of both editions of Blue Rose is actually my husband. So it's sort of like a family work. So that's just in a nutshell, a little bit about D&D, a little bit about Blue Rose.
I didn't realize that. That's freaking
awesome. Yeah, that's why I said it.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So I was planning on leaving this for Crystal, since she is actually an employee of Paizo Publishing. Just something that I wanted to let everybody here know about is there's been something that's been pretty interesting come out of Paizo, the makers of the Pathfinder role-playing game, and as of today, the Starfinder role-playing game. Starfinder has been the first opportunity that Paizo has had to create a sci-fi setting. And sci-fi really has, you know, for almost as long as it has existed, had the opportunity to do political commentary, social commentary, social casting forward, and imagining futures where maybe things are different in the world that we live in, maybe society is different in ways that is, you know, better than we live with today. So there's been a great deal of sci-fi, clearly, or sci-fi has a long tradition of there being queer-friendly works, or being interesting works that explore gender and sexuality. That is something that has been very much at the core of the Starfinder role-playing game, that now that Crystal's actually here, she can probably tell us some more detail about. We're sort of doing something of a year in review, and I wanted to let everybody know about some of the interesting conversations that went on at Paizo about some of the gender and sexuality choices on the Starfinder role-playing game. If there was anything there you wanted to share.
Shall we pause?
Somebody said follow the train, and I ended up on my way to Ohio.
Let's go on the train. So we'll get to that in maybe just a moment, but Tanya, is there anything anything in general, but particularly as a critic of video games and gaming culture that you've seen emerge in the last year?
The biggest thing is a game that a lot of people are talking about, which is Dream Daddy. I played it. It's a good game. I may have criticized it, but I like the game, amazingly enough. But it's an interesting game, and there's a lot of queer content, and the folks who made it, there's a lot of queer folks on the staff, because that was a big concern before the game came out and when it was announced. So, you know, it's worth $15. Go get it. I think there's another dating sim that has come out, and Christine loves, what is the name of the game? I'm blanking out on it. Thank you. It's like when you know something, and it just, when you have to say it, it leaves your brain. I have that. I've not played it yet, but you know, it's good queer content, it's sex positive content. So there are a lot of things that I've seen where it's just like, I can actually see myself or people like me in the game, and I just call this game Queer Daddy.
I play that.
Dream Daddy. Now it's Queer Daddy. That's what it is now. There's actually a black dude, and there's an Asian dude, so it's not just all like the same model of white dude, which is the other reason I really like it. So, and I'm not, I will freely admit, I have Undertale. I've not played it. I know it's just got re-released on console.
Thanks, man.
So, at least for PlayStation. So I know that there's a huge fan base among other queers. I have not played it, so I can't contribute to how queer it actually is.
It is charming.
Yay!
And I haven't played it, but have any of you played Mass Effect Andromeda? Okay, yeah. which also...
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. And Mass Effect Andromeda actually went back and added another male character as part of your squad as a male romance option. I can tell you who, unless anyone wants to stay unspoiled. Is that a yes? No? I don't care about Andromeda.
The hand in the back.
Okay. Is that a yes, tell me, or a no, I don't want to hear it?
No, just say it.
Tell us.
They added Jahl as a male romance companion.
No. Nice. So.
Oh, yeah. Yes. No? Yeah. Thank you. No. With many dad jokes. What?
Exactly. they can't hear.
Yeah, you all might want to stand.
Oh God. I'm not a theater person.
There's empty seats up front.
Yeah. Also, please fill in.
Sorry, I'm not a theater major. I did not learn to project properly. As someone pointed out in Dream Daddy, there is a canon trans character, and you can make a trans dad. I have not played as a trans character, but the option is there, and I know a lot of friends were really excited for it. And there's a lot of dad jokes. So if you like puns and dad jokes, come get your dad jokes. And for the Mass Effect Andromeda person, wherever you may be in the room, because I'm short, I couldn't see your hand. They added Jahl as a romanceable character for a male writer, if you have not finished the game or are going to replay it. And Queer Daddy, Dream Daddy, whatever we're calling it, go play it, it's fun.
Dream Queer,
yes! Go, Jahl, you.
All right, so, Starfinder. I think the biggest thing I had a hand in impacting there was... we have an alien race called the Lashunta, which are a callback to old classic sci-fi tropes of, like, green alien women who are hot, and the males are big and burly and stupid, and,
So should we be applauding stereotypes?
I've had issues with this particular, species since the Distant Worlds book came out where they first appeared, and this became our first opportunity to really revamp them, and I think it was Mark Moreland who pointed out in our first playtest that there's no way for you to get a character with a charisma bonus unless you specifically play a female of this one race.
Okay.
So we went back to the drawing board, and Amanda Hammond-Kuntz and Melissa Guillet and I, like, set her down and, like, browbeat him into kind of revising it so that the reason Lashunta sexually dimorphizes is because their epigenetics kick in to make them more fit for survival depending on the stresses they experience during puberty. And just because society was so heavily divided along gender roles, males almost always experienced this puberty that kicked in and made you buff and tough and a super-duper survivor. And because women were always put in academic roles and leadership roles, their stresses always kicked in to make them taller and more intelligent and more eloquent. And as their society has grown less sexist, I'm not saying it is completely at parity, you've increasingly got these two subspecies showing up in the genders they weren't traditionally associated with.
So that was a year in review. Our very quick year in review. And there's more we can talk about. Like, I could talk about, of course, the disappointment many of us had who played Persona 5 and not being able to romance Yusuke.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about that. It's funny to hear that come out of someone else's mouth.
Yeah, because that was a game I loved, but also a game that gave me tremendous frustration for all of the queer baiting. And there was a lot of it. Also, something we sometimes say at this panel, and I realize it's always good to bring it up, because we have many people who return each year, but then also we have many new attendees, and that is on our use of the word queer. I know some people are not, it's not something they're used to hearing, or it might make you uncomfortable. We tend to use it, and I mean, I'll speak for myself. I tend to use it to be the umbrella term for the LGBT family. And I find it just it is so much easier than saying all those letters and more, and just embrace all of us with the label of queer. So at least if you hear it coming out of my mouth, that's the intent, that it's the word that embraces all of us.
So there's one other thing that I want to bring up just for anybody who has not been here for the last 7 years consecutively. This is a discussion where we have put a number of folks who make role-playing games and who are movers and shakers in the tabletop role-playing game industry and the tabletop games industry in general, and games across the board. If all of us have the ability to influence things in our respective arenas, tell us what you want to see. Tell us what has gone well. Tell us that what has completely, like, failed and that you hate. We want to know about it. So over the course of the next year, we can use what influence we have to steer these games in a way that work better for all of us collectively and to make the changes that we want to see in our hobby. So let us know if you have criticisms. We want to know about them. That's super valuable. If there's something that you saw that you like, let us know. That's great. Kudos. We'll keep doing that. So this is very much a forum for this sort of thing, not us talking at you about, like, we did so well.
Yeah, no, we screw up a lot.
All the time.
And on that note, I'm opening the floor to conversation and discussion and questions. Does anyone have anything? Wow, no. Oh, there you go.
So, like, bouncing off what you just said, I know that there's a lot of, you know, there's a huge increase in smaller, like, indie small press games to include queer content and to focus that as, like, the, like, maybe the main thing for, so if you get, like, a really niche small press game that is about specifically, you know, two queer people and their relationship, what sort of, like, resources or efforts do the larger, like, the, to borrow the phrase from video games, the AAA studios, what resources are being, you know, used there to, like, help promote that in the larger community as a whole? Because, you know, it's hard for smaller companies to get that reach.
Well, we, at least, and something I've talked about in the last few years, what we've done with D&D is basically, with 5th edition, LGBT characters have been present from the get-go. They're mentioned in the 5th edition player's handbook, and then in all of our recent adventures, there are queer non-player characters. And that's been true, again, adventure after adventure, adventure. You know, Curse of Strahd, Storm King's Thunder, Tomb of Annihilation coming up next month. Now, these adventures are so big, it's possible you might actually go through and miss them. But then, like in the case of Curse of Strahd, one of the whole subplots is about a gay couple. And if you delve into that subplot, you'll see the entire subplot is about helping them rediscover their love for each other. And again, that's in D&D. So thankfully, it's no longer that sort of work. And this has been true also in Pathfinder for a number of years. This sort of work is thankfully no longer the domain of indie games like Blue Rose and Monster Hearts and others.
Tanya, I wonder if you could mention any of the discussions that you've had with any of the larger studios about the importance of inclusivity.
He needs to have to stand up, doesn't it?
Probably.
Damn it, Russ.
Sorry, old bones.
I'm going to talk to you. So I've actually had a chance to go talk to ArenaNet. I've had a chance to talk to Ubisoft. And what I think a lot of people need to remember is that gaming is global at this point. It's not the assumed audience of 18-35-year-old white dudes, and that's in tabletop, that's in video games. Pay attention to the stats, because what I try to do is bring the stats from the ESA, from the International Game Developers Association annual survey of, look, these are the people actually playing these games. You can't keep marketing, you can't keep building out the same default brown-haired white dude whose wife or kid gets killed. A, we're tired of that story, and B, you know, I would like to be in a game and live past the opening credits. Just saying. But it's reminding them that we're out there. And, you know, and pointing out, you know, this character that talks like she came out of Step and Fetch It? Anyone who's played Deus Ex knows exactly what I'm talking about. That's not accurate. You know, this character sounds like she literally came out of the 40s or 50s. It's 2000 whatever. So reminding people that you are leaving money on the table, and I get very mercenary about that, of you can keep retreading the same stereotypes, but the more you do it, the less money you're going to get from people. And if I have to give more money to indies, I will happily do so. Because I'm going to come to Green Ronin tomorrow and throw all my money at Crystal. for what they sell. I realized how that sounded the second it left my mouth.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
You all know what I meant. But, you know, the long and short of it is reminding people that the audience has changed. The audience has shifted, and it's never always been that 18 to 35-year-old demographic. You know, I'm walking around here in this T-shirt or game T-shirts, and, you know, it's also making your space welcoming, especially at the table, because I don't go in game stores anymore. I say this every time I'm at a tabletop thing. Because I don't see people like me. I get questioned as to why I'm there. And if I see a table there and it's like a bunch of dudes look like they could be like my old white uncle, I'm not going to stay. So you need to actually walk the walk. If you say you're inclusive, show me. Do more than just one women's night a month. Or, oh, it's June. Remember, gay people exist. You might want to buy dice. So it's actually doing the work and continuing to do the work. Not just this one-off, oh, it's Women's History Month. I guess we'll remember that there are women in tabletop. It's doing the work. So, and paid diversity consultants.
Yes.
Before we have any other questions, as you all saw, Joe came in, so I'm going to get him to do a proper introduction of himself, and then we can kick back into the conversation.
I apologize for my lateness. The elevator that's supposed to get me up that I'll give it was totally not working, which means that my partner and I were lugging my wheelchair up the stairs. So that was fine. My name is Joseph Carricker. I am a developer for Green Ronin Games. I've worked on a variety of games, even outside of that. Done a little on the 3rd and 5th editions of D&D, and et cetera, et cetera. I kind of helped put this together way back when, and I'm happy to see it continuing. Yeah. So thank you, everybody, for being here.
So questions.
Hold on. Crystal.
I got kind of thrown in medias res.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Crystal Frazier. I developed for Green Ronin and Paizo, and I've written for Green Ronin and Paizo and Palladium and Eclipse Phase and Mutants and Masterminds. Just many, many things. It's been about 20 years. So, also I illustrate and do cartography and edit. Oh, and I'm a lesbian trans woman.
Yay. Woo!
I need no introduction.
I know, exactly. Okay, so let's kick into questions. I saw one in the middle first, and then I saw you, and then I saw you. So, I think, yeah, that's it. There he is.
With the, I feel like with the queer movement, it started with a whole lot of attention on the gays and lesbians, and then as bisexuals kind of elbowed in a little bit, and then as we have grown over time and understood there's a whole lot more under our umbrella, there's been a lot more subtlety and nuance in understanding different folks from different backgrounds and where they're at, and I think it's awesome that there are gay and lesbian characters and stuff. Do you think we'll see over the next year, 2 years, more even diversity beyond that with poly characters or trans folks that are mixing and matching amongst a lot of those different sets?
Okay. Well, yeah, at this point we've already had a couple of poly and trans characters in Pathfinder.
There was one in Wrath of the Righteous. It was a person born as a male who, if memory serves, that felt like they were born the wrong gender. And their lover, a female half-orc paladin, gave up all of her family heirlooms just to get this potion, just to give it to this person, and that they could become who they want. Yeah.
And we've had a few more since then. I know we had one in Rise of the... or Hell's Rebels, and... Mm-hmm. We've had at least a couple of poly families in different city gazetteers I've written.
Yeah. And likewise, in the
most recent Baldur's Gate expansion, there was a trans character that again caused the internet to burn down. And although, to be clear, that's with a video game studio that works with Wizards of the Coast. That isn't work we did ourselves. We also have had bi characters in our work, but it's something we say this every year on this panel. Our view at Wizards is we can always do more, and we will do more. There's even a nod actually to this very question. If any of you who follow our Unearthed Arcana series on our website for D&D, there was a new spell we put in called Ceremony, and one of the magical ceremonies you could do is you could infuse a wedding ceremony with magic. And I made sure very carefully that it was worded so that it would work regardless of the number of adults engaged in the ceremony or their genders. And I was glad to see there were fans who read the wording and like, wait a second, this works for everybody. And that was very intentional.
And just to highlight real quick what Jeremy said about the character in Baldur's Gate, written by Miss Amber Scott in the front row here.
Good to meet you.
But in sort of more general sense, though, yes. It's like, I do think that we're going to continue. This is... I'm so loath to use the term, like, this movement or something like that. But really, like, I do believe that studios and companies have increasingly seen, like, studios, especially large studios, are very conservative because they have bottom lines. And they're scared that, oh, we put a gay character in there, and then maybe our thing won't sell. But now there's a great deal, definitely need more work needs to be done, but we see queer characters come up in a vast spectrum of products, and the world has not burned down. So I think companies are increasingly being like, not only does this not affect our bottom line, maybe it even improves it, and since we've, you know, hit these notes again and again and again, there are companies that are increasingly seeing the value of diversity consultants, or seeing the value of inclusivity, and that is starting to spread out farther. So my hope is very much yes, and I'm optimistic.
And really, I mean, that success, right, like we can talk about these varieties of sex, it really sits with all of you, right? Everyone who purchases these things. When we have management who are like, well, we're not sure if this... Because, you know, like patriarchal culture, one of the things that it said is if you go with the gay, there's like excisement. You're going to be shoved aside. We're going to, and that bit of mythology has even come through into the business world and all of that. And that's why management thinks that way. And so when we make a point of purchasing products that include us and telling the companies that we're doing so because of that, right, that helps to dispel that myth in a very like effective way.
You were next, yeah. And then you, and then you, and then I think somebody. Yes, there. I got it down.
So whenever I run a D&D game, I always try and keep diversity like open, genders and races open. But whenever I include someone who's either gay or lesbian or like transgender, it always either comes off as me bashing them over the head, like as an example, like this exists, right, like. Or it's comedic, right? Like, even though I'm very serious, like, this is just how they are, my players always assume I'm doing it as a joke, or, yeah, for them, right?
This seems like a good topic for a seminar.
Well, yeah, actually, on Saturday, several of us will be doing a seminar called Queering Your Setting, and it's about integrating queer elements into... your D&D game or any other role-playing game that either you're playing or a world you're creating. I mean, this is a topic we actually come back to often in this panel, and that is really how do we make sure we're including queer characters in a game without people feeling like
as they love to say, shoving it down their throats. And which, again, makes me laugh every time, no matter how many times I hear it. Because, good Lord, are they obsessed about things going down their throats.
They really love that mental image.
Yes, they do. Yes.
My brain was.
but something, and this is advice not only I would give to game masters, to writers, and it is advice I specifically often give to our writers, is just keep at it. You will stumble, and particularly because even those of us who are queer, you know, it's like in a way we're writing about ourselves. Didn't grow up with examples of writing about ourselves. Right. So even we sometimes stumble writing about ourselves because all of our models when we were growing up is basically being outsiders observing someone else's experience.
Right.
And so even there's that temptation to other ourselves, to almost think of ourselves as foreign. So one thing we have to do, and this is why I recommend so much, just keep at it. Because eventually it will feel natural for you as a storyteller. You'll be able to internalize as a storyteller what probably you've internalized as just a person, apart from being a storyteller, is we exist.
Right.
We're a natural part of existence. Our being present in a story is no more remarkable than anybody else being present in a story. But again, the only way we get there is just we have to keep at it. And that can include this kind of... this didn't go over very well. It's just like, try it again.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we sometimes hear, like, because I, of course, talk about these sorts of things on social media and that sort of thing. And the one that always shows up is the person who's like, well, I'm cool, like, with a character being gay, as long as they're, like, you know, it's not just for no reason. Like, as long as there's a plot reason for them to be gay.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. My point is, I am gay with no overarching plot. Gay people just happen. We don't need a reason to be on scene with our gayness in hand. We can just be there.
Yeah.
So, like, don't... So, you will sometimes encounter people who are like, oh, well, you're trying to, like, hit us with this political... A, my life is not politics.
Right?
Right? So it's not political, it's personal. Right, and that's very much that because saying we're a political issue is othering, right? We're trying to be told, well, you're not part of the regular real life. You're over here that gross politics. I beg to differ.
Right.
There's an awful lot of us for us to be othered that way, but we're accustomed to like letting ourselves be. Right, and let's be honest. In some situations, it's dangerous for us. Not to object too strenuously to that, but we can just happen to be in the tavern, right? We don't have to have a reason for us to be there and gay. Those can just happen. So,
and in fact, something I have stressed to our team at Wizards of the Coast is, I almost never want to see a reason for a gay character to be there. I want the gay character. Or the lesbian, or the transgender character, or the bisexual character, or the questioning character, or the asexual character, to simply be there the way everyone else is there. And the way I actually got the team to get it is, because, again, it's a growing process. I love to point out in a number of our adventures when I'm doing my review, and I'll say, so why did you tell me this man and this woman are married? What's the story reason for you telling me this? Why did you tell me this other man and woman are married and have kids? Why do I need to know about their sex life? And as soon as I start pointing out that they're basically shoving this heterosexuality in our faces with no story reason. No. I don't want it down my throat.
This is non-consensual.
But they got it. But they're so used to that being the norm becomes invisible to them. And again, that can even happen to us as queer people. if we again can even see our own presence as being remarkable instead of the very natural thing, as you say, Joe, that it is.
Okay. I've seen a lot in gaming, a lot more inclusivity. It's a process, like you were talking about. In my personal community at home, gender nonconforming is a huge thing that you didn't hear about 2 years ago. Trans is in the forefront in a way that it hasn't been before. I just want to challenge people as they think about development to stay on top of and bring in, you know, bring in characters that represent all of us. Yeah. And in representing all of us, the big fat guy needs to be a gay guy too, not just a idealized, perfect, pretty boy. Work beyond just the stereotypes for the characters and a cross-section of all of us, all races, all sizes, disabilities, and able-bodied folk. Let's see more of all of that in reflected in the games we play.
Yeah. I agree. Okay, I had that.
So, a bit touching on the point with Alicente, but just generally about gender sort of as a mechanic in role-playing games. So I really enjoyed when I was reading, like most RPGs, you read about creating a character and you read, oh, gender, and it has no effect on the stats of the character. Like in every setting, like there may be certain settings where it's like, women are more likely to be warriors, or people that identify as men are more likely to do so-and-so, but, like, everyone can do everything, and it's great. It's great that that is a trend that has come out in a lot of role-playing games. But I read a game recently called Saga of the Icelander. I'm not sure how many people are familiar about it, but it has gender as a stat. You have a stat that is gender. And all of the playbooks or classes you pick are, you're basically setting up an Icelandic community in the wilderness. And part of the sagas is that there were very clear male and female roles. And I was thinking about this, and I'm like, is it a bad thing to tie mechanics to genders or orientation or that sort of thing? Do you think that's something that can make role-playing games go into a difficult territory, or is that something that we might want to explore now that we've already gone over, okay, we can do role-playing games where no matter your sexual orientation, everyone's equal. Now we can explore divergence, like in the Alicentes, where now I guess we're having...
I think we got you.
We got the question.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I think it's generally a bad idea, especially as in the case of the Lashunta, where the stat division already reinforced gender stereotypes that we exist. I mean, Sutter wasn't thinking about this being like, oh, this is a sexist stereotype, let's reinforce that. He was thinking, oh, these stories I really love from my childhood had this, but they come from a time when we had very different ideas on men and women. And I think any media you create has the power to say very clearly about what should be normal and what should be reinforced and what should be accepted or expected in society. And games aren't any different. If anything, I think games are a little more powerful about that because you're investing yourself personally into it instead of passively reading or watching somebody else work.
You used an example of the Saga of the Icelanders, and I think there's something to be said for it can be fun to use games to model certain types of stories. But I think we need to not ever lose sight of the fact that this is an art form that is not being practiced by those Icelanders of, you know, the pre-Christian, you know, Scandinavia, but by modern people. Right, and I think that I also think that we often make the mistake of thinking that broad generalizations, which is the case with the Icelandic sagas, broad generalizations somehow have to be reinforced in the individual. Right, so we can say men do this in the Icelandic sagas, and think like a game designer may think, well, this means that all men have to do this in my game, and only men have to do this in my game, when in fact the heroic sagas are almost without exception about people who in some way transcended, exceeded, or transgressed against what was expected, whether we're talking about, you know, whether we're talking about the sagas that deal with, you know, feuding families, or those who had transgressed against the gods, or what have you. So to say, you're creating a character who is a hero in this type of story, but you must now be limited by what is a broad generalization, is frankly not fun. You know, like there can be. There can be a lot of fun to be had in, now see, and I think settings, rather than mechanics, is a better place for that. Because you can have settings that are restrictive, again, as long as everybody at the table is aware up front and everybody's willing to play. You know, you can have settings that are extremely sexist or homophobic or what have you, particularly when your players are going to be the ones to throw that kind of thing down. Right, they're going to be the ones who trod that under their jeweled sandals and this sort of thing, because they're going to change the world because they're freaking heroes, right? So yeah, there's a lot of fun to be said, a lot of fun to be had with that, but I think it's a mistake to try and take those kind of generalizations and say, well, we need to like mechanically enforce them, because really all that is saying we're not allowing there to be singular individuals who diverge from that. And the reality is, there's almost no generalization that you can make about anyone that someone in the world does not violate, does not transcend. And I think we need to think about creating heroes like that.
Okay, so one sec. I know there's a few other people that I have on my list, and then I will add new people. Right there. Yes.
So, I am transgender, and I'm really happy that I've been seeing more and more transgender characters show up in role-playing games and, you know, things based on role-playing games, like a Baldur's Gate character recently. But I have a question about how, in those games, do you think it's best to approach the actual process of transitioning, which is something that's really sort of integral to a lot of us as our experience. And when you start introducing things like magic and shape-changing or scientific, like, advanced technology and that kind of thing, how do you approach that experience and still treat it with respect, but put this the twist of the setting on it?
That was a lot of pointed stares.
My lane, Crystal. I'm staying in my lane. Good.
So this is a question I ask myself a lot, because I have at this point written trans characters for three different companies, and I don't know that there's any one perfect way to represent it. I personally see a lot of value in the process of transition itself as something the trans community tends to bond over. I mean, you get any two trans women together in a bar, and inside of 30 minutes, they're going to be comparing scars, basically. It's just a thing in the community, and I think, like, a quick fix magic potion that anyone can afford, or, like, a 25-cent gender change booth on your spaceship is probably ideal for most trans people, but it doesn't reflect the real experiences and needs of people living right now and what they see in themselves. So, while it might not be... I feel like I'm rambling. So, yes. Well, I mean, there are a lot of good arguments for perfect... quick changes. I also see a lot of value in using your setting to mirror the real life experiences, especially of minorities. In Pathfinder, we've got a gender change potion that costs about as much as a house, which, if we're comparing that to things in the real world that rearrange your body, that's not too far off. But we've also introduced alchemical hormone therapy, basically, which is a much slower change, and it's only about as much change as real-world trans people can get from hormone therapy. And it's way more affordable.
Okay, you were next. Yeah.
So one of the lines that Green Ronin has just announced is a game that we're calling Modern Age. It uses a system that several of our games use, and we have three sort of iconic characters for it. One of whom is stated to be non-binary, and you know, they use they, et cetera, et cetera. And actually kind of does sort of embody that. I think in terms of other developers seeing and wanting to go to that place is, you know, visibility, right? Like, we all have the folks, the queer folk who are most common in games are those that our culture has seen again and again and again, right? And I think that as sort of different flavors of queer folk also, like, kind of reach for that level of representation and visibility, that we'll see a lot more of that. But game developers, we are consumers of popular culture, you know. But having writers, having freelancers who are themselves familiar with these nuances, with these differences, with these traits in people, immensely helps us as developers, because we can draw on your expertise, right? And I will guarantee you that there are things about non-binary folk that I don't know, but that's why I want a writer who does, and I want to make a point to hire that writer, right? And I think a lot of us up here are the same way. We depend on our freelancers to some degree to bring their expertise, whatever that is, to the table. And
And this, just one quick add-on to that. In one of our upcoming books for D&D, Xanathar's Guide to Everything, this was something specifically on our radar, and we ensured that a number of the characters in the book have indeterminate gender identities. It was our goal. We pushed the artist, make it so that any two people who look at these characters will come up with a different answer. Mm-hmm. And because we wanted to make sure our characters were not all, I mean, so in a way, I'll back up a little bit. We've already crossed the threshold of ensuring that our heroes are a 50-50 split of male and female. So now we want to go push further and have then characters where they're neither, they're both. It depends on what you as the viewer, or you as the player, since we're showing you possible characters you could play, to encourage you to think beyond that binary.
There's another interesting sort of hurdle that non-binary folks face, and that a lot of other queer folks don't, or just male and female folks don't. And that's the English language.
Really any
language. Well, really any language, yes. Because you often have these companies that have editorial standards and practices, and they use this language in this way, they use these rules terms just so, and they, as a pronoun, is used as it is stated in the Chicago Manual of Style, which is plural. So increasingly you're seeing editorial operations changing their style guides to be like, but they can also be a singular pronoun in these instances. This seems very minor.
this is the language that we speak. This is the way we rule or view the world. This is a very sort of subtle and pervasive thing that seems like it doesn't carry a ton of weight. It carries all of the weight because editorial operations are in many cases notoriously stodgy and don't want to make these changes. They're, we have a thing, we do the thing, that's what we do. If you do see a company, a group, whatever, using the plural they, if they got that far, that was an argument they had to get there. That is not following the momentum. That is not following the, I have not checked my Chicago manual of style in some time, but I'm going to bet you it's not following the manuals that they typically cue off of. So if you see that, please let these companies know, hey, we see what you did there. More of that, please. And that will help.
Just behind you, Jeff. Sorry.
Going along with the, like you said, you know, sometimes the big guy, has, you know, you can't have the idealized male figure, what have you, and that everyone experiences the spectrum of sexuality differently, different ethnicities. There's, you know, differently able. Like, how do you experience this thing like that? Is there any exploration of the different races in the thing, like the hyper masculinity of orcs? What do they view as like? Well, that's a really like, yeah, it's kind of queer what he's doing, like, you know, in their hyper-masculinized minds, or do halflings have a different take since they're very egalitarian, you know, like more stereotypically homey, things like that, you know, the elves are very effete and aloof, and does it really matter to them, if, you know, how, what are their takes on this, like, you know, is it more serious to change one's gender? It's like, oh, you can love the same gender, but, you know, God forbid you try to change what is set in stone. Like, you're a stodgy dwarf, you might not like that.
At least in D&D, our stance is that, at least among all of the playable species, sort of queerness is distributed amongst all of them the same amount. So, you know, humans are no more or less queer than elves, than dwarves, etc. Now, the one asterisk there is we do say that elves, more than any of the other races, are gender fluid because that is specifically a blessing of their god, Corellon, who is represented throughout the history of the game as being male, female, both, or neither, and that is a blessing that elves can have, and that it is seen as a blessing that that elves, if they have that kind of fluidity, it shows in a way they're still like the true elf, because they can flow, and that it's almost like a sadness for that other elves ended up sort of in a fixed form.
I just meant along the lines of just like just the concept, like I said, orcish culture is hyper masculinized in the sense of everything, you know, power, strength. Would a female orc who loved other female orcs, you know, and sought to assert herself and love who she wanted to love by amassing power, by smashing all those who naysayed her love, and, you know, is she just going to be viewed as transgender? Like, you know what I mean? Like,
you know, my take on this is go for it. Yeah. Like, do what's right for your game. If you want to see characters like this in the different societies in your game, that's fantastic. Great. I mean, totally explore that. A lot of folks up here are going to be talking about that tomorrow as well. But there's a lot of neat options. Saturday. Sorry.
I mean, just to point out, you do see two femmes get together, too. So.
Yeah, so two butch women occasionally do get together. I know.
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, I think it's a good question, but it's one of these things where, as soon as the game hits your table, don't look for us for answers or that stuff. Do what you want for it. I mean, if you think that would be cool to explore, absolutely. And then come here and tell us all about it, and then we get to be like, "Oh, that went that freaking well." Okay, yeah. We don't have product schedules to fill or anything.
So, Yes.
The one thing I would say is that I think it's a mistake to assume that a warrior culture has to be hyper-masculine.
Yeah.
So, that, there we go. You know, I don't know if you've been watching Vikings, but like that has no problems having children and taking
blood. Yeah, I meant specifically orcs as portrayed. But, yeah, oh, definitely. I think the Amazon would be a prime example of that.
What's going on?
In a community setting, the more egalitarian...
Excuse us!
Sorry, guys.
Sorry.
So I think that it's a conversation that's okay to have, but I think that I'm gonna pull the moderator card and I'm gonna play my X card right now and say that we're gonna stop this conversation, and I'm gonna carry on with questions and stuff going on. So Jeff, you're on my list. The lady at the person at the back there with the
So I just wanted to circle back a little bit. I just wanted to say that I myself, as a queer game consumer, I would love to see that happen more often, if only in a, you play the game in a, you know, from queer friendly publishers, and you play the game and then, you know, you finish it and kind of like at the end of a World War II documentary or whatever, and you're like, oh man, I'm really glad my life's not like that. Like, you know, like kind of like you feel like it puts you in the shoes of other people who maybe those rules are enforced upon. And I definitely get that it's a dangerous path to walk, but I think that it could be done very well in a way that would be enlightening. Like I said, I as a queer game consumer would appreciate it.
I think we talk a lot up here because it's... from our experiences, that we work with some relatively large publishers, Green Ronin, Wizards of the Coast, Paizo, a number of others. And a lot of those games are very much aimed at, and a lot of those games are very much aimed at, how can this game be everything to all people? On the other side of that, though, a ton of indie games explore some really fascinating concepts when it comes to sexuality and gender, and really do a deep dive on some really niche ideas. I am not the person to speak about this, because I am not terribly familiar with it, but have any of you played Rene Naip's game Kagematsu? Okay, so maybe I am the person.
Good job, Russ.
So just as one example of that, Rene Knight, who has joined us on this panel for a number of times, published a game called Kagematsu, which the name of which I hope I'm not butchering, but anyway, I'm sure we'll hear it in the recording. Anyway, so the concept of the game is very much that. It's a feudal Japanese game where I'm trying to not muck this up. Where essentially all of the men have gone off to war and just have been completely slaughtered. And a new warrior comes into town, and all of the women, have to essentially use either their wiles, bribery, whatever have you, to convince this wandering Ronin to stay and defend them. Now, the interesting element of this game is that it is written into the game that the men playing this game, the physical male players, have to play women. And the male character, the Ronin character, has to be a female player. So through the course of this, it is exploring that whole element. So and you can kind of see how that unfolds. I mean, and all of the things that you expect happen at that point happen. But it's a really sort of fascinating game in that it takes that meta experience and just plops you right. It's like, no, you are doing this, you are doing this, you are doing this. Now play. If you have the opportunity, swing by the Indie Press Revolution booth. That's one great one. Monster Hearts comes up again. There's a ton of indie games that do great things with gender. Please do check them out, because there's some really exciting work being done there.
I am crashing Joe's panel, because Joe came to crash my panel. I'm going to recommend Bluebeard's Bride.
Yeah, oh my god, yes. Yeah. Could you please tell us about that?
Bluebeard's Bride is by Sarah Richardson, Risque Hay, I think. Mm-hmm. Of Bluebeard, you know, personal fears and insecurities manifest as monsters in each of the rooms. So you are playing through the mind space of a woman who is trapped in a marriage and is probably doomed to die at some point. And
it's dark.
It is one of the best horror games I have ever played. Please, please, please play it at some point with people you trust first time.
And my understanding is that like just combat is not an option.
Combat is an option. You can dirty your hands with violence, but you actually take a trauma point to this game instead of hit points. So your mind actually slowly breaks as you attempt to hurt people.
Nice.
What company makes that?
It's by Magcrack. You can also find that at the IPR booth.
Nice.
Because it just came out.
That's nice. Awesome. Thank you so much for mentioning that. Fantastic call.
I have to run out to Contessa because
doing that, but thank you for joining the Crasher panel. So it seems like we've kind of circled around a couple of times my question, so sorry to retread a little bit, but I've been thinking a lot about what is ideal, like what would ideal in big quotes queer representation look like in mainstream culture. I sometimes feel disconnected from settings that I consider a little like more utopian, I guess, like the D&D setting, which I so like really appreciate its inclusivity, but also sometimes when I am playing it or thinking about it, it just feels so weird because it's so different from my own queer experience. I've been trying to think about like what would be the sort of goal of queer portrayal in culture and in games in particular, when people's lived experience is so different. And it seems like indie games and mainstream games maybe are doing different things or have different ideas about that.
I feel like in a lot of ways the sort of more utopian vibe that we've gotten from a lot of games, Blue Rose among them, and D&D and that sort of thing, are sort of the pendulum swing in the other direction. I totally understand what you're saying. There's something to keep in mind when it comes to, and we'll talk more about this on the panel on Saturday. Our understanding of a lot of queer identity comes with assumptions of struggle, right? It comes with assumptions of transgressiveness, right? Like we understand culture, our culture kind of wants itself to be this, and our queerness stands in contrast to that, if not in straight up conflict sometimes. And sometimes it can be hard to separate, like what does being queer mean in a setting where the default assumption isn't that there are dudes who want to punch me a whole lot because I have a boyfriend, right? What does my queerness mean in those settings? And to some extent, like, taking those utopian settings and asking that and coming up with some answers can be a whole lot of fun, you know? But I also think there's value in, again, as long as everyone at the table is on board, in playing in less utopian settings for exactly that reason, right? Because for a lot of us, our queerness is kind of tied into being in conflict with the larger culture in which we've grown up. And sometimes we want to play through elements of that in our characters that have been or maybe have never been, but we've seen these dynamics while we were growing up.
And I think, something that you said, Joe, that and then I wanted to tease out a little bit, is that I think we really want to see a spectrum. And so that spectrum, I would love for it to continue to include that kind of hopeful, utopian view, partly so we have an aspiration, you know, that there's a land we want to get to, but also absolutely have stories of our struggle. Otherwise, it's too easy for the people who cause us so much suffering to get off scot-free. And also, it can be so cathartic for us to tell stories of our own struggle. Now, with D&D in particular, One reason why I ensured our default was the utopian version is because D&D is a storytelling platform in addition to being a set of worlds. And so I wanted to make sure that the default settings of that platform were positive for us. Now, a particular group can do the stories of struggle that Joe was talking about, and I think could do so really fruitfully. But I didn't want, especially with a game that would be getting into the hands of tens of thousands of people around the world, to have as its default struggle, especially by DMs who might not understand that struggle. And so in a way have again, default is that hope. But again, I hope the hard stories are being told at people's game tables.
I also want to be that person and remember that any representation is going to be hard to have an ideal, because your ideal is not going to be my ideal.
Right.
For me, I would like to live in a world where, you know, I don't have to be afraid of cops. I would like to be able to walk down the street and not worry about, like, things going on at the table. Ideally, I want that fantasy, but that's me. Other people may want to have different experiences. But for those 4, 6, however many hours I'm at the table, I don't want to think about that. I don't want to think about the real world. I want to roll dice and have a drink with my friends. But, you know, ideally for me, I would like to exist in this fantasy setting, this space setting, what have you, in a way that I can't now. Because that struggle is part of everyday life and reality. And if I have to sit here and struggle in a dice game and to have somebody to attack me because I dare have a girlfriend or a wife in this setting, you know, that for me, that's not fun. It, you know, people may want to work stuff out, and people have worked things out through tabletop, which is great. But we all have to remember, when we start talking about ideals and representation, everyone's ideal is different. I want to be I want to be a tiefling or a dragon and fly or do whatever the fuck I'm going to do. Sorry, I'm swearing. in a game, and just set logistics, real world aside, I struggle enough as it is. I don't need that at the table. But again, that is me. Everyone else, whatever it is you're getting out of gaming, that's cool. But I just think as much as I hate the term, it's a slightly damp slope into talking about ideals, because again, like Wes, all of us on here, everyone's ideal is going to be different. I just want to crack open a beer, sit with my friends, and roll dice for 6 hours. That's what I want.
Yeah, I'm going to echo what Tanya said. There's a lot of value in a resistance narrative, but there's also a lot of value in just pure escapism, where you don't have to, I mean, I don't need to role play what it's like to have a shitty life because I'm trans.
Okay, awesome. Thank you very much. Jeff.
So, Wes, you're mentioning the Chicago Manual style and made me wonder. Your games aren't played all in English.
It's true.
Or in American, European type settings. Were there any struggles with some of these games internationalizing and trying to project some of the gay, bi, trans, intersex type issues?
We had this conversation the day Wes and I realized that
shit's real.
Yeah, shit's real, and somebody could be thrown in jail for owning a book we publish.
Whoa. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, and that's something Wizards of the Coast also faces, not only with some of our, like, we're considering a translation of the 5th edition books into Russian. Well, we have to now figure out what that means, because we don't want to put somebody in danger. And that's also come up even with some of our online fiction for Magic the Gathering, because we've started to have queer content in our short stories for Magic, and those stories, we had an incident where there was a story that had to be, I think it was like suppressed in China, because we suddenly realized that it would have been illegal for people to be reading it, and it was heartbreaking. But yeah, these are the kind of dark realities we have to face when we are not only confronted in our individual lives by the fact that there's still a lot of progress for us to make in our own country. It's very sobering to realize how much further behind many other countries are. And of course, there are some that are also ahead of us culturally. But it always, whenever I'm faced with anything like this in work or in life, it just, it often breaks my heart, but then also gives me this resolve that even when we start feeling comfortable, like, woo, we can get married and we have acceptance, it's like, oh my God, we have brothers and sisters and non-binary siblings in other countries where their struggle is literally life and death.
I mean, at the end of the day, there's no easy answers for this. I mean, today everything is international immediately. It's like, it doesn't matter the language, it doesn't matter whether it is translated into the thing or not. If you put out content, people who want that will get that, and sometimes that will put them in danger in the place that they're in. And you have to make the choice. You have to at least have the thought where it's like, oh God, if I put something in here which is right for me and people that I love, someone could die. And it's as stark as that. I mean, that sounds like a gross exaggeration, but it's real. And it's the sort of thing where all of us up here have had some very real and some very hard conversations about that. But at the end of the day, it's just like, that's rough, but we got to keep moving with this sort of stuff. So sometimes it's a matter of like, okay, maybe this work doesn't go there, but sometimes it's just like, we hope things get better for them and whatnot, but we need to keep doing what's right for us. And
to some extent, we also need to not make that decision for them.
Yes.
I mean, there was a time when the same, very same could be said about people, about queer folk here. And the only way that we challenged that was by us making those decisions, owning that material, you know, using it as inspiration to fight those fights. That's a really tough balance, right?
Yeah, because we're only, any gains we have because we've been transgressive. And so it's a difficult road.
We always get this seminar, by the way. It's always, yeah.
And now we're going to dance to Thriller.
Feels poorly timed.
You good? Okay.
Wait. Yeah. Can't hear you.
I'm sorry, we can't really hear you. If you could even step up
there
a little
go.
Bit, that
Thank
would be
good.
I'm in the early stages of opening a retail store, and I'd like to facilitate a safe and welcoming environment. I want to know for industry, resources, partnerships, programs, or just general advice on making that reality.
So I can actually answer this one for you. I work in a gaming store in Vancouver, and I also am really good friends with Elusive Games in Santa Clara, and they're actually up for any. So get in touch with me afterwards, and I can connect you to them, and they can totally help you out. If you guys are ever in Santa Clara, that game store is fucking incredible. Like, hands down, it's amazing. Elusive Games. Yeah.
I also want to throw a plug out for Donna Pryor in OrcaCon.
Yes.
Yes.
Because OrcaCon is all about diversity and getting more people at the table that are usually not welcome. So Donna's working at the Settlers of Catan booth. So I don't know how much time she'll have to talk, but at least get her contact info. And anyone who is thinking about going to OrcaCon, you're looking at your program coordinator. I want to see not all white dudes submitting programs. That is not a request. but to make your store inclusive, make it very clear that people are welcome. Include if there's any groups in the area that are, you know, all about people of color in tabletop, queer folks. Invite them and make sure people know they're welcome. Don't go, look, I have queer people at this table. Yeah. Look at me, aren't I great? Just go, I want you to be welcome at this store. I know it hasn't always been the case. And I'm just going to give my email address because this is what I do as part of what my daily work is. TANYA at ineeddiversegames.org. And I'm going to tell y'all now, I like a lot of my friends. I don't work for free because I got bills to pay.
That's right.
But I've gotten this question before, and it's easier to do in a one-on-one conversation based on what your specific needs are, but walk the walk. Just don't put a sign up and forget about it. You know, watch how people are interacting in your store. If you don't see people coming in, open the door, say, come in. You know, we're new. I want you to be welcome here. Make it very clear that folks are welcome and show them that. So, I mean, that's going to go a long way because people in the community will notice it and they'll realize that you mean it.
Just to throw in one element, other element on this, and I completely understand you're a businessman, you're going into this to make money and whatnot, you've got to be willing to fire some customers over this. Mm-hmm. You're going to get that asshole who comes in, and he's going to poison your entire store for not just every, you know, that person that he pisses off or that group of people that he's prejudiced against or whatever have you, but people of those demographics will notice and they will tell their friends. So the potential for one person to have every woman who comes into your store be like, yeah, I'm never going in there again, and I'm going to let everyone I know that, or, you know, every queer person, person of color, whatever have you. It sounds draconian, but you gotta, if you're serious about it, you gotta be, you gotta commit.
So I would like to tell a quick anecdote based on your comment, Wes, about normalizing editorial standards. I got a outline from a publisher last year to do an adventure, and one of the characters, it was ambiguous if they were male or female, and the idea was that I could choose how to detail that character, but I assumed that because they used the pronoun they, it meant they were non-binary, so I wrote the character like that, and that's how Athira got its first non-binary character, so that was pretty fun. And I just thought that was a cool illustration of how, you know, changing language really does change our thought processes and how we work. Also, my question is, hypothetically, what would you tell a hypothetical person who worries that they're not queer enough to contribute to the industry?
You're queer enough.
Yeah. I worry I'm not queer enough to have a legitimate voice.
Well, that's why I'm asking.
You're queer enough.
Right.
And that
No.
Oh,
that insecurity is something we all have and something we need to learn to quash.
Yeah, I like on my social media often talk about you know, queer topics and this sort of thing, and very often my attempt is to get people to say yes, that like I am allowed to be that queer. I'm queer enough to say that's not cool to say, or that sort of thing. And you know, and I even have, like, there are so many of my friends whom I love dearly who are like, you know, I'm a bisexual woman, but I'm married to a man. I know I don't really count. And it's like, no, absolutely not. If you are queer in any capacity, you are queer enough to say, to stand up, and to say, this is the way things have to be. This is the way we need them to be, right? Because if we're truly going to say, we need everybody, right? Everyone that is queer, that's a huge voice. Right, that's a huge population of people, and we need to, and you know, and we have done imperfectly in the past, right? Like I'm gonna call us out, not anybody by name, but gay men, we suck at this. We have done terrible things. We have made bisexual men's lives very difficult. We have made, you know, etc. Right, but we need to be willing to say, oh, once again, it's not about the white dude. And this is about all of us, right? And no matter what that queerness is, someone is queer enough. So, yeah.
I kind of like the queer enough question. It blends into, I was going to ask a question about asexuality representation and how sometimes that's a tricky area because someone who's asexual could be heteroromantic.
Yeah.
How is the gaming industry today working to include people who fall under the asexuality? And does it even belong under the queer umbrella if they are heteroromantic?
That is a good question. I mean, that's a question, and
It may not be an appropriate question.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's...
We have several different diversity committees at Wizards of the Coast. The one I'm on is the queer one. And this is something that we've discussed there, and we didn't come to a conclusion. Basically, the conclusion we came to was anyone who identifies as asexual, who identifies as queer, is welcome at our table. So really, it's really about self-identification, right? that if the asexual person is queer in their heart, they're queer. And so really, we left it, it's to each person to decide. Now, something I've mentioned before on this panel is that particularly in our game, which is a platform for storytelling, so often that choice is really up to the player. And that's, again, why mostly what we try to do is remind people that there's a huge range of human behavior and appearance and everything that they could explore, either in their human character or their non-human character. So I certainly hope people are including asexuality as one of the many things that they can incorporate into a character they bring to life in their role-playing game.
I know for me, that's queer enough. You know, mostly because, to some extent, whenever you have an orientation or a gender that stands at odds to what we're told is the norm, right? Regardless of what that is a candidate for queerness. Right, and so even if we're talking about, you know, a heteroromantic asexual, frankly, asexual folk, there's assault that happens because people have this whole idea about what it takes to cure it. You know, that is an assault on a queer person, right? That is no different than any other of these kinds of things that happen. And so as far as I'm concerned, oh, I swear to God, I'm about to come through that wall like the Kool-Aid Man. Oh, yeah!
I'd pay to see that.
So who's got a hat? For you?
I will give you $20.
I'll match that $20.
Right. Pass the hat.
Make space. You search yourself.
Yeah, probably. But yeah, like, and for me, it's really about that. Like, you know, I will never tell someone you're queer, right? And because I feel that people need to step into that for themselves, you know. So I have those friends who are bisexual women who are married to straight men who are like, I don't feel that. I'm not comfortable with that. And that's totally, like, you have to be the one to make that call. But I totally think there's space for all of that.
And really quick about that, it's not just, especially because I'm bisexual and I'm in a long-term relationship with a cisgender straight dude. The community itself has made me feel unwelcome. It's not that I don't feel queer enough, because, hey, that's vulgar, I'm not going to say it. I can self-censor on occasion. But, you know, thank you. It's... The community unto itself has made me feel like I don't belong. So that's something that needs to be addressed before we start talking about, well, I'm not queer enough. Who has made you feel that way? Or have you been so indoctrinated with that from day one when you realized I'm not straight, but I'm not straight. And if anyone ever says half gay and half straight, I might just flip.
As well you should.
Yeah, that's a thing. But, you know, I think it's a community issue that we have made people feel unwelcome. I no longer go to Chicago Pride Parade because of that. I don't participate in a lot of things in the community because of being made to feel, well, you said you're bisexual.
It's a ringtone.
Oh, I expected Scotty or her.
Yeah, we're about to be beamed up.
Right, please.
But, you know, that is something we need to address internally. It's coming from inside the house. And we can't fix it from outside the house until we do that.
I have to go.
Who said you could go?
I would love to stay. I have another panel I actually have to get to. Oh, you've all been lovely. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jeremy. But you stay over there.
I will. See if you find out. No more questions? No? Okay.
There's seats in the front.
Yeah, I got seats in the front.
Yeah, there's
so,
yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
All
seats
that are super loud so they can hear us.
I know. Okay, so I have,
we have
space
a
for more questions.
Yeah.
Yeah?
So, very frequently in video games, a good example is like Dragon Age Inquisition.
Oh, Jesus.
Female warrior with the shield. I forget her name. Right?
Aveline? Mm-hmm. Cassandra?
Cassandra, yeah.
Okay.
That's her.
There's more than one.
She kind of like breaks that mold for being the female warrior, right? But she then jumps straight into a different mold by being. Having the buzz cut scar and being like, "Oh, gung ho, I'm better than all the men." Right? Is that,
do you have a question?
Yes. My question is it a serious issue for a character to jump out of a mold into a different one?
Oh,
as just like postponing the issue, saying like, "Hey, like, let's just throw them a character that like throw the issue under the bus and like start throwing."
I've got this question because. So for those who don't know, I'm a big Dragon Age nerd.
Okay.
And so it's like, I could sit here and take the rest of the panel to talk about this, but I won't. Cassandra's a stereotype. She presents a soft butch to a lot of people. She is, and I'm going to spoil it, fuck it, deal with it. Her romance is very much I read romance novels, I'm a big softy, I'm this warrior, but she's part of a group of people, a clan in Navarre that hunts dragons, where she had to fight for that place to be seen as a better warrior. For some reason, even though in the Dragon Age universe, women are warriors, it's not a big thing, players and sometimes the writers have assigned weird patriarchal stereotypes to the characters. She has romance, she's het only, to many people's dismay, but I have mods for that. Yes.
I'm sorry, they're giving the high sign that they can't hear you in the back.
What? I can't. Well, I'm iterating. Wes is going to make me stand up. Damn it.
I didn't say that. You did that.
Well, if people can't hear me, I'm going to speak. So, Cassandra's stereotype. She is very much a stereotype of the hardened warrior who, you know, that I think they subvert in a way because she is that soft character. She is very much, I want my romance. I want my roses. I want... She likes Varric's smut. The smutty literature, she puts it. So it's not bad. We are getting a character who presents a certain way, and the bro dudes are mad because, you know, like, she's not pretty enough. Fuck them. She is who she is, and I think they actually did a good job subverting the trope of this very butch-looking woman being very soft and wanting that field of romance and you know, I'm not fucking out in a hayfield. I don't know about anybody else. But, you know, that's what she wants. And it's not good or bad. This is the character we got, and
right.
You got to meet her in the second game as this very hard and tough character, but then we get to actually meet her and learn about her in Inquisition. And that's where I'm going to stop, because if not, I will talk about Dragon Age.
I was
going to
say, I leave for 2 minutes, and
I'm
back to Dragon Age.
Well,
ask the question.
And I think it's worth noting that, like, you were discussing molds of characters.
Yeah.
So those are somewhat useful storytelling devices, and if you never transcend that, you have what we call stereotypes.
Interest.
Right? Stereotyped characters are boring. Right? They're not interesting. They are an easy hook for someone to make assumptions about a character, which is why you want to then subvert them. Right? And I'll actually, another thing that is very important, we talk about representation, and, you know, people are like, well, this you know, group of straight people, they have this one gay person there, like, that's cool, right? That's enough. They know.
First of all, we travel in packs.
Thank you.
Like, clearly.
And it's like, who wrote this? They don't know any gay people.
And, well, and the other thing is, there's a difficulty with when you have with stereotypes, particularly stereotyped queer characters, even though this character is not queer. When you have queer stereotypes, it can be problematic. It can be problematic when you have that single character be a stereotype. Because in any cast, any character that has a label that they're the only ones who carry that label, anything you say about that character, your writer is saying about that label. Right? So if you have the super effeminate, lisping, flouncing, etc., etc., right? All the fun, you know, adjectives that you want to add on to that, and that character is the only queer one. I'm going to give you some side eye, right? But if I have multiple queer characters, not only is it absolutely okay for one of them to embody a stereotype or another, but I think it's a lot of fun. Like, it can be really cool. Plus, I know gay men who are like that. So, like, I'm not okay with saying that's verboten. You must never present gay men in that way. Like, half my friends. What do you know? Like, you know? But yeah, so that's the other thing. When we're talking about running games and casts of NPCs and things, if you are worried about, like, is this queer character that I'm presenting too stereotypical? It might be, if they're the only one. Right? Diversify your cast.
Okay, sorry, no, I got a list. Yeah. And then I'll put you on the list.
Can I do something real quick?
Yeah.
My question is, Wes, do you mind if I hijack your seminar for 30 seconds?
I'm sorry?
Do you mind if I hijack your seminar for 30 seconds?
Depends. What are you hijacking it for?
Tabletop gamers.
By all means.
So, there are a number of events going on at Gen Con. If you go to tabletopgamers.org, it's the one that's on the ribbon, there's a list of events. I wanted to point out real quick, and I promise I'll make this quick, that right after this, over in Union Station, Edison South, which is on the second floor, is the Gamer Gathering. We got it late this year, but we're playing board games. Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. for you morning people is the intersection of inclusion and storytelling. It's a seminar over in Crown Plaza. We're in Crown Plaza, Pennsylvania Station, which is, I believe, just down the hall. Tomorrow, Saturday, as mentioned, is the Queering Your Setting from 5 to 6 here in Crown Plaza, Grand Central Station D, which is the next room over. So, and all those are on tabletopgamers.org. If you can't remember that, look down. If you don't have a room, so
Jeff, I want you to know that that is not hijacking. That is a vital function. And we will endeavor to make that a vital function that happens at the beginning of the panel going forward. Excellent. Thank you for calling us on it. All that's fantastic. And if you haven't checked out tabletopgamers.org, you have a thing to do after this panel.
It's true.
Thank you.
Okay. So, yeah.
I wanted to maybe hear from something that Tanya said about community. One of the things that I found a little difficult is that finding safe, comfortable places for queer people to play in their communities is not always the easiest thing, especially when you're home and you join a meetup group. It's not always easy to find a queer meetup group, so sometimes you just try to find one, especially if you move around a lot, and you hear words like, oh, that's so gay, or you hear, you know, the F word, and I'm not talking about that F word. You run around pretty often, and, you know, you might want to call people out on it, or, you know, it might not always be a comfortable position to call people out on things like that. It depends on where you are, and then you leave that group and you try to find a different one. What do you guys have to, you know, offer as advice about finding, you know, in terms of community, finding safer opportunities for queer gamers to join gaming groups and, you know, opportunities for gaming?
Tabletop gamers, Gamer X, no California event this year, but anyone who can get to New York will be recurring November 4th and 5th. And guess who's the diversity liaison? That'd be me. Reach out to those groups. Again, I gave my email out earlier. If you didn't get it, I'll repeat it for you later. We're trying to reach out and tell people. And I would say when you go to meetup.com, filter out for queer inclusive groups, or go to places where, you know, there's dice and gay folks. And if you, and just, I'm going to be that person. Just because we're all queer together doesn't mean we can all be queer and happy together. Know when a place is toxic and when you need to get out of the house because a fire started in the kitchen. Don't be like the Sims and just hang out and burn to death. I have killed many a Sim that way. But, you know, look, find your people.
Yeah.
And just find your people at events like this, or if you go to PAX, come to the Diversity Lounge, things that you're doing. And I'm not the biggest fan of PAX, even though I've gone a couple years, but they are starting a tabletop-only event this year in November. So this is your chance to go plant those seeds of sedition and get paint rainbows all over PAX.
Right.
Go do it.
Hey, real quick, for that guy who was starting the game store, you want to put your money where your mouth is? Dice and Queer Folk is a great name for a game store.
I want my 10%.
One of the other things that I would throw in, though, is as much as I want to be a fire thrower and just be like, you go out, you find that space, and if you need to take that spice, you do it, but biting as many necks as you frickin' have to.
And I'll come back to Alucard with you.
That was everything I wanted in the Castlevania show. But anyway. Anyway, we'll get back to it. You can read my fanfiction online.
Oh, really?
In from Tor, whatever. We are no longer living in a world where we have to be 100% happy playing the games that we want to play with the five other people that maybe we don't like, but they're gamers too, so yeah.
Right.
Online options are increasingly becoming not horrible. I will say. Like, there are a lot of programs out there. Roll20 comes up a lot. Do a search, you'll find them. I wouldn't say any one of them and is like, oh, and this is a beautiful, perfect experience and whatnot, but every day these are improving. You can also see communities on Twitch that are doing some really exciting things. And increasingly, you can take a look at what's being done, being broadcast on Twitch and YouTube. You can emulate those, and you are no longer shackled to the meat space that might not be the best for you, and you can build that community online in a much more engaging way.
I would also say be willing to teach. Like, you may have a difficult time finding particularly other like queer gamers, but it's actually a very feasible thing to make more queer gamers. The simple fact is, so we kind of have this idea of
being
like,
recorded.
Good. I want them to know my agenda. So we have this, like, there's sort of this thought of period during our adolescence when most folks get into gaming, and regardless of how true or not that is, that, you know, was for a lot of people. But for many of us, that was also the point in time when we were figuring out who we were. And role-playing can be a very, very vulnerable time. Right, because you're putting a lot of yourself creatively out there, and you're sort of like taking in what others are doing, and there's a sense of vulnerability that can come with that that a lot of queer folk stepped away from. Like, role-playing seemed a little dangerous, right? And so I can guarantee you, if you have queer friends, find the ones who are big MCU fans, right? They're big Marvel movie fans, or they're comic book collectors, or they've got several shelves on their bookshelf full of fantasy and that sort of thing, and say, hey, so you know that super nerdy gaming thing I'm always talking about? How would you like to learn? You interested? Like, because I'd love to have you in a game with us. And you will be surprised how many people say, you know, I kind of always wanted to do that, but I never really had the chance. I never, like, knew anybody that it felt like it was, you know, because they were all kind of jerks or whatever. And you would be amazed how easy it is to put that group together. Yeah, you'll have to go through the growing pains of teaching folks to game and that sort of thing, but, like, there's something to be said for being willing to put that together. What you cannot find in the world, sometimes we must build. And, yeah, so...
Okay.
So someone asked this question last year, and I found it really helpful, so I wanted to ask again, just with the amount of games that are coming out every year, but in an effort to put our money to support the projects that are adding diversity across the board. Well, everything. Anyways, like, what role-playing games or tabletop games, you've mentioned a few already, but are there any additional ones or companies that are particularly inclusive or diverse that you guys recommend for board games and things like that?
It's the plug your shit part of the show.
I will point out that I started working with Green Ronin because in the first edition of the Blue Rose role-playing game, they, on every other page, went into detail about how it was great and perfect and accepted to be gay or bi, and never mentioned being transgender except in the flesh-shaping spell, where it specifically mentions using the spell that can correct parts of your body you're unhappy with, is always corrupting. And so when they announced second edition, I sent an email to Chris Premis saying, hey, this is obviously just an unintended consequence of not mentioning this minority. And he's like, oh shit, you're right. You want to write for us?
Oh, there you go.
So that's the kind of company Green Ronin is.
I have no shame. I have two Patreons. One is for my personal expenses, so I can actually do the work of I Need Diverse Games full-time. Because I tried having a full-time job and doing that. I like sleep too much. So I Need Diverse Games is now a 501c3 nonprofit. We're getting reclassed for charity, but hey, we can still take money. If you'd like to give us money, we have a Patreon, which is patreon.com/INeedDIVGMS. Because I Need Diverse Games do not all fit in the URL, unfortunately, just like our Twitter handle. And then my personal one is /CypherOfTears, CypherOfTyr. And as far as other things going on, I've ended my podcast because solo podcasting sucks and I'm bad at it. I know my limits. But I've joined Spawn On Me, which is a podcast based out of Portland with three dudes and me. I'm on every other week. Eventually I'll go full-time guest with them, but talking about all sorts of games and diversity and inclusion. So
that was Spawn On Me?
Spawn On Me. And actually they'll be streaming, it'll be late here, but 7:30 Pacific time, they have now started streaming to Twitch, and Austin Walker is the guest tonight.
Joey, you have anything?
I mean, yeah, we've mentioned a bunch of those names up here.
Like, is there any books or anything that somebody should read?
Yeah.
Something that somebody might have written. Right. I don't know.
So that book is in that green bag. Someone handed it to me.
So I recently published my first
Joe's
novel.
Book.
Oh. The novel is called Sacred Band, and it is about a team of LGBTQ supers. Who basically exist in a setting where this whole, you know, golden age of superheroics is in the past, because the, you know, government decided that was a little too vigilante-ish. But they kind of run into the fact that, you know, law enforcement and military and all of these official groups that are supposed to look out for everyone, they don't do that equally. And there are sometimes groups that get ignored or looked over, or even sometimes specifically targeted, and so they decide to do the illegal thing and put together a team of queer superheroes to take care of some of that for themselves.
So there's one other thing that I want to throw out there, and it's, yes, we're all lovely people doing lovely things. But the one other thing that I would throw out in there is support the Fringe. You've got, you know, big video game companies, big companies that are doing RPGs and whatnot. They are on board with, like, okay, we'll do more inclusive stuff. But you can't really look to most of the big players for the new radical thing. And you typically can't look to them for the next generation. So for in games, check out I Need Diverse Games, but also check out Indie Press Revolution. They're a publisher in the dealer's hall that deals with a lot of small press, small print books, but it's all many of them are very niche concepts, but they're radical games that are doing things that you're not going to get from some of the big players out there. On top of that, many of them, you do a little research, or you read the book, you read the back, you see what the game is. If you see the game, if you like the game, if it's doing something that you want to explore, it's going to mean a ton to that creative that you bought their book. It's going to perhaps give them the opportunity to make the next book or the next game or whatever and keep them rolling. So while your dollar is certainly important with like a Wizards of the Coast or a Marvel or a whatever have you, if you can get that money directly to a person who's
this
creating...
This is more what I was looking for. Mm-hmm. I hear all of the stuff that you guys are doing, but
yep.
What are those?
There's also GamerX, which is now a 501c3 charity.
Yep.
And are you still doing Tabletop for California?
Yep.
So Tim is actually running Tabletop for the California events. We are having Tabletop at the New York event in November. So, you know, their inclusiveness and about queerness. And, again, OrcaCon, while not a nonprofit, this is the first year coming up where they're not doing Kickstarter. So any kind of either financial backing, word of mouth to get ticket sales can help, because everything is about widening the net for Tabletop. And for those folks who live in Seattle, you know how it is. This year the whole theme was diversity, and aside from me and a couple other guests of honor, there still weren't a lot of brown folks there. So we need to get more people visible, because the feedback I often get is, I've seen you at this convention, I've seen you write or stream, so I don't feel so alone. So it's also visibility.
Right.
It's not just throwing money at people. Money's great, we'll take it, but it's going to mean a lot more to someone to go to Gen Con, to go to PAX Unplugged, GamerX, and see more people like themselves, because queerness is always presented as very much cis and male. And that's the example that we get.
Another element of this is also, this is a big room with a lot of people. You have a lot of very charming folks in front of you right now. This is a small group. I mean, it looks like we're doing a lot of stuff, and it looks like, oh yeah, we were at this thing, and we did this, and we do this, and this is cool and whatnot. There are five of us up here right now. Like, this is one bad day on the road away from, like, this not happening.
Yeah, especially because we hang out.
Yeah. Yeah. So, to go back to some of the stuff before about, like, are you queer enough? You're queer enough. Now get to work. Like, if it... And I, like, all of you are lovely people, but I'm especially talking to the women and the people of color in this room, where it's like, get out there, and if you can write, if you can speak, if you can talk about it, if you love your art and whatnot, please put it out there. Show it to people. So if you're comfortable getting a following, if you're comfortable in that space, we need more of those voices, because increasingly... Not perhaps increasingly, but certainly the trend is you see the people that have come before, and if those people are like you, you feel like, oh, that's a thing that I can do, let me just do that. And it just repeats the same stories again and again. We want to get a diverse group of people, of genders, of sexualities, of ethnicities, in the places where they're the ones making these calls and then guiding these stories, so they're telling the stories we all want to see. So certainly, if you've always thought, well, maybe I'm not good at writing, none of us are good at writing. Just keep doing it until they pay you, pretty much.
Until your editor stops crying.
So nobody's perfect up front, but you only get good at this stuff by doing the thing, by repeating it, by failing. And we should, all of us up here especially, should talk more about our failures in social media and whatnot, but to a degree human nature. It is to a degree human nature, and definitely the the view of a lot of folks who are on the outside, that they only see the successes. So they're like, oh, that person's talented. First, talent's not really a thing. But second of all, it's just like, we have all been climbing over, like, our own corpses for so long. Like, we just failed again and again and again. But we don't talk about those because, hey, look, 1 out of 100 things, it went well. Maybe we can repeat that. So you're going, you have the potential of, well, actually, you're all probably brilliant. You're all way better than we are. It's just going to go great for you. but really, go out there, and even if it means failing, don't let that deter you. Make your games, tell your stories, do your art, let your voices be heard, let your stories be told, because that's how you get to be the person who's writing the next Dragon Age, or like doing the next D&D thing, or advising to Marvel and whatnot, and it's got to be better than what's there now.
Yeah, and I'm actually doing a panel on failure about hustle and flow and what you don't see. So if anyone in this room is going to be at PAX West, I'm actually going to have that conversation.
That's awesome.
So
you're going to get the last question. However, I need you four to keep it short. I'm only going to give you a couple minutes, and I will cut you off.
Lightning round.
Woo!
So no pressure.
No pressure.
So you guys started out by saying that like a large part of this panel is wanting to hear what we want to see. And something that as a bisexual woman has struck me that I don't see very often is characters that are queer, they are gay, they are lesbian, but they also defy the masculinity or femininity norms for that. I see a lot of lesbian characters who are very butch presenting. And watching Wonder Woman recently was an amazing experience for me because she's repeatedly described as beautiful, but she kicks ass. Mm-hmm. I want to see feminine warriors. Mm-hmm. I want to see gay male warriors who are big and strong and buff, and they fight alongside their shield brother, who is also their lover. You know, I want to see the defiance of those stereotypes, because as much as a stereotype is a good hook, I want to see people be like, wait a minute, you know, a big tough man can also be gay, and that's cool and accepted by like his fellow warriors. That's cool. Or, you know, oh hey, like she's absolutely gorgeous and she can fight in her chinkini. But she kicks serious ass, you know? Like, I want to see the defiance not just of the gender stereotypes and the sexual orientation, but just of masculinity and femininity norms in general.
And I would love to see a bisexual character that actually lives and is happy and is not out here trying to fuck everybody.
Good homework.
That's it, everyone. Really quick, let's toss out your social medias. Crystal, would you please start? If you want to follow, people have people
I'm
following.
On Twitter at Amazon Chic, CHIQUE.
Easiest way is Cipher of Tears, CYPHEROFTYR, and I Need Diverse Games is I Need DIVGMS.
You can find me on Twitter at F Wes Schneider, S-C-H-N-E-I-D-E-R. Also on Sundays, I play games for the internet on Twitch. So you can also find me there at, I think it's just Wes Schneider.
It is.
I'm on Twitter at Oakthorn, O-A-K-T-H-O-R-N-E. And then I'm on Facebook under Joseph Garrett.
Where can people get Sacred Band?
At the Green Ronin booth.
Yes, my wonderful bosses at Green Ronin have donated a chunk of booth space for me to sell Sacred Band out of this year. So if you are interested in a copy, you can get one at the Green Ronin booth, number 1321. Thank you, everyone.
I would like to have a really, really massive round of applause. For you. I want to thank all of you guys for showing up as well. So from us to you.
Thank you all of you.
Thank you, Tim, for moderating.
Yeah.